Greetings, interwebs, and welcome to my second presentation on the issue of talcum powder litigation. Today I'm going to focus on the cross-examination of a lung cancer plaintiff with a smoking history in the context of a talcum powder case. But actually, I think you'll be able to apply this to almost any personal injury litigation, and I'll explain that in a little bit, but particularly in the area of a toxic tort or a product liability caused by exposure, I think you'll find this very useful. For those of you who have not taken my first class here at Esquire CLE, my name is Roy Viola. I am a partner at Hawkins, Parnell & Young. We are a national law firm. Our headquarters is in Atlanta, but we have offices all over the country. I practice in the New York City office. We specialize in a lot of different areas, but my practice focuses primarily on product liability, toxic tort, personal injury litigation, construction litigation, and I handle a lot of different litigated matters relating to product liability suits. And one of those areas that I focus heavily on, and in fact, increasingly so in the last 3 or 4 years, is talcum powder litigation. My practice involved a lot of asbestos product litigation, opioid litigation, construction, and chemicals. But I find that particularly, say, in the last 3 to 4 years, that my practice is becoming consumed more and more by talcum powder litigation. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to talk about it. One of the reasons I gave my first class in talcum powder litigation. One of the reasons I'm following up with Esquire on another course today. I have been a litigator since I was a prosecutor in the Army from 1994 to 1998, right out of law school. I'm licensed in New Jersey and Pennsylvania, but I've handled a lot of different national accounts that required me to monitor and supervise litigation on behalf of some large clients occurring throughout the United States. And yes, I said New Jersey first because I am a proud son of the Garden State. My discussion today will not really focus too much on specific of state law. It's sort of a compendium, and the topic that I'm going to be discussing basically involves science, and of course that's applicable everywhere in the United States. Still, I previously gave the introductory class here on Esquire related to talc litigation, and in that class I discussed some of the basic issues related to talc emerging litigation in the country, and it included some of the threshold topics such as the definition of talc, where it comes from, how it's used, and I focused on the various Daubert and or Fry standards that were utilized by different courts around the country examining these cases. It was impossible to give that class without talking about the elephant in the room, which is asbestos litigation, and indeed today it will be virtually impossible to do this second class without talking about the history of asbestos litigation in the United States and how it led in a very direct way to talcum powder litigation. So, today I want to take a deep dive into this area of the litigation that's become a bit of a niche for me. It involves cross-examining the smoking lung cancer plaintiff. In other words, a plaintiff who is claiming a disease that is caused by exposure to your client's product, substance, chemical, or what have you, and also has a fairly significant cigarette smoking history. I also want to touch a little bit on a growing number of plaintiffs in the United States, and those are lung cancer plaintiffs who have no smoking history. And there's some interesting developments that are going on right now, and we'll talk very briefly about that as well. But today the bulk will be focused on how to prepare your case, particularly your discovery deposition and then your trial cross-examination of a plaintiff who is alleging lung cancer caused by something other than cigarette smoking. In other words, the product you're defending. If you don't specialize in toxic torts, I still think this will be instructive for a number of reasons. Most importantly, I think it's a good exercise on how to look for nuances in a witness's or a plaintiff's story that you can pick away at. And by being methodical, I think that's the key to what we're going to be talking about today. By being methodical in your cross-examination, in building a cross-examination that's very methodical and detailed, you can craft a cross-examination that damages the narrative of your opposing witness's testimony. So, even though a journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step, we should just take a quick step back initially, and let me do a quick refresh from the first class I gave. I guess it was about a year ago, maybe a little bit earlier. Or if you haven't taken my first class entitled, unironically, Talc Litigation, a Primer, well, shame on you. In fact, I believe it's offered by Esquire for the ridiculously reasonable price of $35. And I don't know if it's offered as part of Esquire's compliance bundle or their ethics bundle. It's not an ethics bundle, but it might be offered as part of a compliance bundle, which in the age of COVID is a fantastic way to meet your CLE requirements around the country. I know I use Esquire, particularly to make sure I get my ethics credits. And when I need credits, I get them through Esquire. And they have compliance bundles now that allow you to take substantially all of the necessary credits in whatever jurisdiction that you practice. So if you need a non-ethics credit, I shamelessly recommend this class and my first class. But even if you haven't taken my first class, not a big deal. This is not like Stranger Things or The Queen's Gambit, where if you miss the first 10 minutes, you've lost the plot entirely. I like to think it's more like The Mandalorian, which involves sort of a plot-ambiguous amount of raucous fun from start to finish in each separate episode without the adorable green baby Muppet. And after all, each episode of The Mandalorian was kind of the same plot, but it didn't stop people like me who watched the original Star Wars in a drive-in movie theater. Yes, I'm that old. It didn't stop me from devouring each minute of Mando's adventures with Grogu and considering it the best of Lucasfilm's offering. But I digress. And with this CLE, if you didn't get the first one, that's not a big deal. Let me give you a little backstory, and we'll be off on a rollicking adventure into the chasm that is talcum powder lawsuits. It is impossible to talk about talc litigation without talking about asbestos litigation. And you may not have much familiarity with asbestos litigation, but believe me, it's big. It's been around a long time. And it is a dominant tort lawsuit that exists in the United States. I run into lawyers all the time, whether it's in the courthouse when, you know, we were actually going to the courthouse live, or I, you know, I meet people around where I live and talk to them, and they ask me what I do, and I tell them what the kind of practice that I have, and I generally talk about my toxic tort product liability involving asbestos litigation. And almost to a person, when I talk to another lawyer, they always say something like, that's still going on? And yes, the answer is that asbestos litigation in the United States is alive and well, and it's not in any danger of going anywhere anytime soon. And in fact, this is important. It's important to understand that asbestos litigation is the most expensive product liability litigation in the history of American jurisprudence, period. Nothing else comes close. Not pelvic mesh, not drug litigation like Risperdal or opioid litigation. It's asbestos litigation. It is responsible for the bankruptcies of hundreds of companies and the creation of literally hundreds of billions, that's billions with a B, of dollars in bankruptcy trusts for the payout of asbestos claims around the country. So very briefly, where's the asbestos litigation come from? At one time in our country, and around the world, in fact, asbestos was referred to as the miracle mineral. Asbestos is a mineral, like talc is a mineral. It's mined from the earth, and it's virtually indestructible. You cannot burn it. You cannot destroy it with heat, at least not the kind of heat that is generated in commercial and industrial settings. And asbestos fibers were of the quality and nature that it could be used in almost unlimited applications. It was finely powdered, so you could mix it into paints and all sorts of different compounds and mastics. It could be woven into gloves. It could be used as the main ingredient in a matrix for automotive brakes or pipes or insulation or roof shingles or joint compounds or sprayed-on fireproofing or literally thousands of other products. It was used in high school science kits, in hair dryers. It was used all over the United States. And in fact, in many areas of the world, particularly in emerging nations such as India and China, it is still used fairly significantly. The United States Navy used literally tons of asbestos to insulate all parts on ships. In fact, the United States government, along with two other companies, the Johns Manville Company and a company called UNARCO, the United Asbestos and Rubber Company, were the three major consumers of asbestos in the United States. So you may ask, well, what in the world does that have to do with the talcum powder litigation? Well, the short answer is plaintiff's lawyers. Full disclosure here, I am a defense attorney, and so you may enjoy that grain of salt with which this particular section is offered. But the plaintiff's bar is responsible for the emergence of personal injury litigation against talcum powder companies. Question is why? Well, here's the short answer. As the body of scientific knowledge related to asbestos continued to grow, as it became apparent that asbestos would not be a viable component in industrial and commercial applications in the late 60s and the 1970s, a growing group of medical experts, including a gentleman named Irving Selikoff at Mount Sinai Medical Center, began to publish articles related to the asbestos and diseases that it caused, and its prevalence among certain occupations. His first groundbreaking study focused on insulators, but he eventually studied many other fields and is sort of the father of industrial hygiene in the asbestos arena. And in 1972, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration came into being in the United States. Its focus was on worker safety standards in the workplace. One of the areas they focused on was exposure to lots of toxins and chemicals in the workplace, but also asbestos. And to make a long story somewhat less long, it was no longer viewed as the miracle mineral that it once was. To be sure, asbestos has never been outlawed in the United States, and it still finds its way into some products. And as I mentioned, particularly in some of those industrial nations that haven't a really well-developed worker safety apparatus, think China and India, you can still find it. It's still being mined around the world. However, in the United States, in Europe, and in Canada at least, it has been literally three decades since asbestos was widely used in products around the country. One of the reasons that this is the case today is the tsunami of litigation that really exploded in the 1980s and became a cottage industry for some lawyers, starting in the 80s, particularly in the 90s and even into the 2000s, and continuing on today. Literally thousands upon thousands of cases were filed in the 80s and 90s. When I first started doing this litigation, the New Jersey docket, for example, had thousands of active cases. Now, many of those were non-malignancy cases, asbestosis cases, and you may ask yourself, what's asbestosis? Well, we're going to talk about that today. But thousands and thousands of cases. You had all of these workers who were working in various trades and fields, and some of them were getting asbestos-related diseases because of the widespread use of asbestos around the country. And what you had was a large population of workers in these different categories: insulators, plumbers, pipe fitters, shipbuilders, boiler workers, carpenters, assembly line workers in the industries where all of those products were manufactured. All of these workers who handled or made those products in the 50s, 60s, and 70s started getting the asbestos-related diseases 20 to 30 years later, and we'll talk about that as well, and hence the flood of litigation. And places like Baltimore, Philadelphia, New York, cities with a very obvious, robust industrial and shipbuilding history became epicenters of the asbestos litigation. And other places did as well, primarily due to the favorable environment for plaintiffs. That included such far-gone places as Madison County, Illinois, where I believe it's still considered a judicial hellhole by asbestos insurers and defense groups. And the reason isn't because of the bridges of Madison County. That's actually in Iowa, not Illinois. But the point is that some of these places became literally focal points for asbestos litigation, and they handled tens of thousands of asbestos cases. So the question you may ask is, why in the world is this litigation still steaming along 30, 40, 50, 60 years after these industries were at their height? Well, the answer, my friends, is what we call latency period. Generally defined, latency period is a seemingly inactive period as that between exposure to an irritant, such as a virus or a chemical or a substance, and the onset of the illness caused by that irritant, commonly referred to as the incubation period or latency period, and between the instant of stimulation and the beginning of the response. So latency is the period between exposure and the onset of disease. And in the asbestos field, latency is the period of exposure to asbestos to when the first onset of asbestos-related disease occurs. For those of you that practice in toxic torts or even have a passing knowledge of viral loads or other areas involving irritants, you know that some latency periods are relatively short. Others are many years. Well, asbestos is one of the substances where the latency period is actually measured in decades. In most cases, it's 20 to 30 years from exposure. Most experts will tell you that the latency period for asbestos exposure to cause mesothelioma, for example, is 10 to 50 years. And in fact, most experts in mesothelioma cases will agree with you that any exposure to asbestos that is less than 10 years from the date of diagnosis is not causative of that plaintiff's disease. So what we have is a toxic substance capable of causing serious disease with an extremely, extremely long latency period. So you have obviously groups, for example, insulators, insulating with sprayed-on fireproofing, insulation, what have you. They're being exposed to asbestos at fairly high levels and significantly dangerous types of asbestos, and that's probably for another day, another class. And then 20, 30, 40 years later, developing asbestos-related disease, pleural plaques, lung cancers, mesotheliomas, asbestosis. Now, since asbestos fell out of favor in building products and in all types of manufacturing in the United States of America, the number of people with asbestos-related lawsuits has dropped quite a bit. But still, more than 2,000 people each year are diagnosed with mesothelioma. And although it is a very rare disease compared to other cancers that we see in the United States, pleural mesothelioma has no cure. Now, I am quite certain that everyone who is listening to my talk today has seen a commercial or a bus passing by with the mesothelioma lawsuit advertising. That is one of the reasons that asbestos continues to be the most expensive toxic tort litigation, product liability litigation in the history of the United States. As I mentioned, asbestos may have been illuminated in new manufacturing and building in the 70s and 80s, but it doesn't mean that asbestos was totally eliminated from every existing building and product that can be found across America. For example, on 9/11, as many people are aware, the destruction of the 7 buildings of the World Trade Center released significant amounts of various toxins into the air around Lower Manhattan, and among them was asbestos. Sprayed-on fireproofing was used heavily in all seven buildings of the World Trade Center, including Towers 1 and 2. And when the buildings were destroyed, you had a tremendous release of the fibers in all of those toxins, including asbestos. So we are now approaching the 20th anniversary of 9/11, and what we have seen is diseases that have shorter latency periods, various different types of cancers, you are seeing an increase in the population of people who were there at Ground Zero, rescue workers, people who did remediation work, recovery people, people who cleared out the site, getting these diseases. It's more likely than not that there will be a spike among those people in mesotheliomas, probably beginning sometime in the 2020s. And you will continue to see people around the country, particularly in industrial areas, large cities that have that still have large industrial bases, you will still see them getting asbestos-related disease. It is not uncommon for someone, a plumber, for example, to have worked around asbestos quite a bit in the 70s and even the 80s. And even though that's 35, 40 years ago, there are still incidents of asbestos-related disease, including mesothelioma, arising today and into the near future. Although the seriousness and the value of the existing cases have increased, the volume for the plaintiff's bar has not. So as I mentioned earlier, this has been a lucrative business for asbestos plaintiff's lawyers. Some of these firms have made literally millions upon millions of dollars handling litigated asbestos claims, and they obviously want that party to continue. As the number of asbestos-related diseases declines, there's still a focus on cashing in on the cases that still exist. Another reason that there is less litigation is the dozens of bankruptcies that resulted from the huge cost of litigation related to asbestos lawsuits. I mentioned the dozens and dozens of bankruptcies that occurred in the 80s and 90s and the 2000s continuing to today, resulting from the enormous cost of litigation related to asbestos lawsuits. What happened generally is the insurance companies for these manufacturers, suppliers, that dried up as the claims continued, and they just overwhelmed these companies. And it's common. The Johns Manville Company, as I mentioned earlier, one of the three largest consumers of raw asbestos in the history of the United States, was responsible for a huge market share of asbestos-related products. They made a product called Transite Pipe, which was basically an asbestos pipe. It was used all over the country in plumbing applications. They declared bankruptcy. They set up a trust. Plaintiffs now are free to file claims to these various trusts. That is in lieu of a lawsuit. But the asbestos lawsuits that I handle now, many times we still are involved in bankruptcy claims and identification of bankrupt entities, but they are a different animal in our litigation. Some states, like New Jersey, for example, are called second injury states. I mean, you can have a lawsuit in the 1990s for asbestosis, which is a non-malignant asbestos-related disease. And let's say you filed a lawsuit in 1994, you collected on that, and then 30 years later, you developed lung cancer or mesothelioma. Well, you go back and file a second injury because you now have a malignancy. I promise you this has come up many, many times in those second injury cases. If you compare that person's first lawsuit filed in, say, 1994, and compare it to the lawsuit that he filed in, say, 2017, you would be shocked. You would not be able to recognize a single defendant named in both lawsuits. And that has led to a great deal of suspicion on the part of insurers, and the defense bar in general, and actually involved a very large lawsuit.
Esquire CLE's first verification code is SAT. S-A-T. All lowercase. SAT. Please take a moment and write this down. Esquire CLE's first verification code is SAT. S-A-T. All lowercase. SAT. Please take a moment and write this down.
Filed by Garlock, one of the companies that is involved in the bankruptcy trust business, where they looked into some shady practices by plaintiff's lawyers relating to the bankruptcy claims. Someday soon, I will hopefully do a CLE here on Esquire related to the rules of professional conduct and the requirement that all pleadings be made in good faith. But you will not be surprised to hear that asbestos lawsuits are very often filed, naming 40 to 50 defendants who are then sorted out during discovery and pretrial. Or maybe you will be surprised because that's not the kind of practice you're engaged in. Well, that is commonplace in asbestos litigation, particularly in the 90s and the 2000s. We would often see cases with 50, 60, 70 defendants in it. And the vast majority of those defendants would fall out, get dismissals or summary judgment along the way. But that's basically how the asbestos litigation was handled all over the country. Now, what does that have to do with talcum powder litigation? Well, so many of those firms who amassed great fortunes from their litigation sought to find new categories of products as the traditional asbestos cases became less common. They looked for their next new big tort. Talcum powder litigation was essentially the natural extension of the asbestos litigation, and it is already in a short period of time proven to be a blockbuster subset category of litigation on the asbestos umbrella. Excuse me. Now, if you listen to my first class involving talcum powder litigation, you know that there were two separate and distinct groups of talcum powder cases. The first involved suits where the allegation was that the talcum powder itself caused the disease. Most of those involved ovarian cancer claims, and early on, this was a dominant emerging area of the litigation. However, over the past few years in particular, the science has essentially determined that talcum powder itself is not capable of causing diseases such as cancer. On the other hand, another area of focus that has become very significant in the plaintiff's bar is the ability of contaminated talc to cause disease as a result of asbestos in the powder. And if you remember from my initial class, we talked about talc, like asbestos, being a mineral that is mined from the earth, can be pulverized into a powder form, has a number of uses due to its absorbency. One of the primary uses of talc is talcum powder for personal use. Talc has a lot of different applications commercially and in personal use products, but it has evolved, and very large subset of people in the United States use talcum powder on their persons, on their bodies, on their children. In the early 1970s is when the first talcum powder cases were actually filed, believe it or not. It basically involved a study by a gentleman named Lewin in 1972, wherein he raised the specter of the presence of asbestos in talcum powder. And that led to some concern among various groups. But it did not get full steam ahead until later. And suffice it to say that the plaintiff's bar has now developed enough expert testimony to create claims that talcum powder contamination is widespread enough to cause disease. What you have is veins of talc that are being mined with allegedly veins of asbestos running through it. And the companies that mined the talc would inadvertently mine asbestos that would then be pulverized along with the talc into talcum powder products and therefore cause contamination to what otherwise was supposed to be pure talcum powder. I, as a defense attorney, maintain, and I will tell you straight out, I believe this is bunk. I believe that these claims are not viable based on science. I will tell you that I believe that the claims that we're defending in the talcum powder arena are caused by some other exposure that has nothing to do with the plaintiff's talcum powder use. And you may say I'm saying this as I look through my defense-colored glasses, and that is that's a fair position for you to take. But the basis for my claim is epidemiology, science. Epidemiology, as many of you know, is the study of disease in groups. And in the traditional asbestos litigation, asbestos lawyers always relied heavily on epidemiological studies that showed that certain groups of workers are extremely susceptible to exposure from working with asbestos-containing products. The science was actually fairly well developed. There was a fair amount of epidemiological proof to support many of those claims. As I mentioned, Dr. Selikoff and the insulators is a perfect example of that. But in talc litigation, there is absolutely no epidemiological proof of any value demonstrating an increased use of the risk of developing disease from the use of personal talcum powder products. As you might expect, the plaintiff's bar in talcum powder litigation has done a complete 180 on the epidemiology, whereas in traditional asbestos litigation, they rely on epidemiology heavily to show that asbestos causes disease in certain groups. In talcum powder litigation, their story changes, and they don't want the court to pay any attention to the lack of epidemiology related to the use of talcum powder products. What they have essentially done is they focused on testing samples of talcum powder from containers, identifying what they call fibers as asbestos, and then extrapolating that based on the number of asbestos fibers that they find in the talcum powder sample, and extrapolating that to the entire container. And therein, they can claim that there are millions of asbestos fibers in one container of baby powder, for example. Epidemiology be damned. However, consider this. If asbestos contamination in talcum powder was such a widespread problem, my friends, then explain to me why the epidemiology doesn't support it. Why hasn't there been a dramatic increase in the number of mesotheliomas in the United States resulting from people's individual use of talcum powder on themselves and their children in the 60s, 70s, and 80s? If, in fact, talcum powder contamination was so prevalent in personal talcum powder use, we would expect to see a large increase in the number of mesotheliomas beginning in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. But we don't. Mesothelioma is what we refer to as a signal tumor, meaning that its existence alone is indicative of likely asbestos exposure. But that is a topic left for another day. What I want to focus on now is the techniques that you can use effectively in your discovery deposition and your trial cross-examination on a plaintiff who has been diagnosed with some form of lung cancer, but is also a smoker. Lung cancer is generally one of those diseases that we accept to be caused by exposure to asbestos, and we also naturally see it in talcum powder litigation. Since it is also generally accepted that certain lung cancers can be caused by asbestos exposure, the plaintiff's bar has seized upon this, given the widespread use of talcum powder over the last 50, 60 years. But I have to tell you that if you focus on good techniques, the most significant cause of lung cancer in the United States has always been cigarette smoking. And so if you focus on the minutiae of your case, you can use this very effectively. By the way, this isn't limited to asbestos or talc claims. There are over a dozen different cancers caused by smoking. Blood cancers, including leukemias, bladder cancer, cervical cancer, colon and rectum cancer, esophageal cancer, kidney and renal pelvic cancers, laryngeal cancers, trachea and bronchial cancers, mouth and throat cancers, pancreatic cancers, stomach cancers, not to mention a whole litany of other diseases that are non-malignancies, heart disease, COPD, diabetes, stroke, erectile dysfunction, rheumatoid arthritis. So a person's smoking history may not only be relevant, but be causative of their claimed disease based on the type of case that you may have. Let me give you a very typical hypothetical situation. I've handled lots and lots of smoking lung cancer cases, and I've seen all different variations in a person's smoking history. So here's a typical one. Let's say you have a plaintiff, 70 years old. He was diagnosed with lung cancer 9 months ago. Let's say it was an adenocarcinoma of the right upper lobe, a very common lung cancer, particularly in smokers. And he's a career mechanic. He also did some home renovation work, and he acknowledges that he smoked one pack of cigarettes per day from the time he was 21 years old until he was 41 years old, and then he smoked another 10 years at a pack and a half a day, finally quitting at the insistence of his family at the age of 51. So using that calculation, which you always use as your baseline in a smoking history, we know he had 20 years of smoking a pack a day, 10 years of smoking a pack and a half a day. We generally calculate this to be a 35-pack year history. So why? Well, for each pack that a person smoked per day for 1 year is considered a pack year. That's calculated as one pack year. If you smoked half a pack a day for 30 years, you would have a 15-pack year history. So you take the number of packs of cigarettes smoked per day per year, and you multiply that by the number of years. And, of course, if you smoke two packs a day, every year is a two-pack year history, and you just add that on the number of years that the person smoked that frequency. In our scenario, we have a plaintiff with a significant 35-pack year history with smoking cessation about 20 years ago. We know adenocarcinomas are caused by cigarette smoking. In fact, adenocarcinoma is one of the lung cancers where the most common cause is smoking by a wide margin. Lung adenocarcinomas account for at least 40% of all adenocarcinomas and arise from tumors that grow in the mucus-secreting cells in the lung. There are other adenocarcinomas, by the way. They include breast adenocarcinomas, prostate, pancreas, and colon. But for our purposes, let's focus on the most common kind, the lung adeno. Smoking is by far the number one cause of adenocarcinoma. Radiation therapy, particularly in the lungs, is another. Radon, which is pretty common in the United States, particularly in areas that are rocky, mountainous, it's prevalent in the United States. That's another cause. And certain toxins we know, such as asbestos, can also be causative, but they are down on the list. In fact, I've seen estimates that 85% of all lung cancers are attributable to cigarette smoking. Why, you might ask, would asbestos defendants be targeted in these kinds of cases? Well, the answer is the path of least resistance. Cigarette companies have one thing going for them in this litigation. Since 1965, or at least 1966, every single package of cigarettes in the United States required some kind of warning. And you can argue about the adequacy of the warning, but a plaintiff suing a tobacco company who started smoking in the mid to late 1960s must contend with those ubiquitous warnings on every package of cigarettes. It is much more daunting to sue a tobacco company, and frankly, you're dealing with a far less sympathetic jury pool. After all, the decision to start smoking is universally made by that person, whereas it's much more palatable to argue that there was some hidden toxin in a commercially available product that this person bought for his own use or was using it in his business or used it on their children, such as baby powder. And remember, the plaintiff's bar has been cultivating asbestos litigation for 5 decades, and it was a natural progression to move into contaminated talcum powder cases. The primary difference between a, quote, traditional, unquote, asbestos case is the design of the product. In a traditional asbestos case, for example, automotive brakes, drywall, joint compound, or thermal insulation, all of these products were designed generally to contain asbestos. In fact, it was the indestructible nature of asbestos, particularly with regard to high heat applications, that made it attractive for use in the first place in those products. Talcum powder is an entirely different kettle of fish. No personal use talcum powder was ever designed to have asbestos in it. So, let's begin. You have a plaintiff who has this significant smoking history. You first, obviously, in your cross-examination of the plaintiff at his discovery deposition, you need to pin this down as best as possible. And you need to ask all of the questions. You need to ask when they started, how they started, frequency. You will find that the more you drill down into the topic, the more likely you are to come up with good, relevant, reliable information. Answers to interrogatories are helpful to a point, but you can use that effectively to prep your cross-examination of the plaintiff. You need to cover in the discovery deposition the fact that the warnings were on a package of cigarettes. Most plaintiffs will not remember or know that warnings were on every package of cigarettes beginning in the mid-1960s. The Surgeon General has required it since that time. And I see this quite often, but there is an issue where the plaintiff testifies incorrectly. For example, in a traditional case, he may testify that he knows a boiler installed in 1982 contained asbestos because it was, quote, common knowledge that boilers had asbestos in them in 1982. But your client knows that's not the case. And same thing with the warnings. How do you deal with this? Well, obviously you can have the court take judicial notice of the fact that there are warnings. And I'm going to be distributing as part of the materials for this course that you will have access to, you'll be able to take a look at some of the warnings that have existed throughout time. There's not going to be much dispute about this. Warnings were on packages of cigarettes for people who were smoking in the 60s. And even if their smoking predated that time, you can still use the warnings as knowledge that smoking was hazardous. On the topic, what do you do when a witness testifies that his wife, for example, used a particular talcum powder in his presence during a period of time you know it wasn't available? I've encountered this a number of times in both traditional asbestos and talc, and perhaps a future CLE should focus on the standard of summary judgment around the country, but if you're a serious litigator, I guarantee you that you could list at least one judge who couldn't care less about the standards for summary judgment in your jurisdiction and routinely deny summary judgment because it's convenient and the somewhat lazy issue of fact. As a former partner described quite perfectly, some judges would deny summary judgment if the plaintiff testified that he worked with Microsoft Blue Asbestos in 1968 and it was personally delivered by a guy wearing glasses named Gates. Just something you have to deal with. And knowing that, it's important that you craft a very effective cross-examination on this particular plaintiff. If the plaintiff has a smoking history that was truly caused their disease, you should expect to find evidence of that in the plaintiff's lungs. There are other causes, or there are other diseases caused by asbestos exposure, as I mentioned above. They include asbestosis and pleural plaques. Asbestosis is defined as a disease caused by long-term exposure to asbestos, and pleural plaques is basically a scarring of the lungs. The fibers from asbestos get into the lungs, they scar the tissue in the lungs, and this is something that is evident on radiographs, x-rays, and CT scans. If the person truly has long-term asbestos-related disease, that should be showing up in the medicals. And if that is in your case, well, that's you have to deal with that. It doesn't mean that their disease wasn't caused by cigarette smoking, But it does mean that you have another issue you need to contend with. And that might be a topic for a later CLE, but it's something you need to be aware of. If that doesn't exist, and that's often the case, then you need to focus on smoking history. I always say this to young associates when I'm helping them get ready for depositions. In a smoking lung cancer case, the case has nothing to do with asbestos. Never forget that the case always involves the plaintiff's decision to smoke cigarettes. If you focus on that, it will help you craft an effective cross-examination. These are the fundamentals. There are four fundamentals of smoking lung cancer cases that I always focus on. Number one is smoking period. Number two is smoking history. Number three is smoking burden. And number four is smoking intake. Let's break down each one of these. Smoking period. This is, simply put, the number of years a plaintiff smoked. It's not always easy as it may seem. You know, people have difficulty remembering things they did 4 weeks ago. It's often difficult to remember somebody's history from 40, 50 years ago, although I do find that in the smoking arena, people tend to have a pretty good memory of their smoking history. But, you know, you won't be surprised to hear that often a person's memory about things that happened 30 to 50 years ago isn't great. So you need to drill down on that with the smoking period. Next is smoking frequency. This is sort of what we talked about, the packs per day. Many smokers refer to their smoking history in the packs smoked per day, and it's a good way to measure it in a way that a jury can see clearly. You want to paint a picture for the jury that this case has to do with cigarette smoking. Doesn't have anything to do with asbestos or whatever toxin you may be defending. It has to do with smoking. Keep in mind, you should always confirm that a pack of cigarettes contained 20 individual cigarettes during the entire period of time the plaintiff smoked, and in a few minutes I'll tell you why that's important. Smoking burden, as I mentioned earlier. Number three, this is the number of packs per day multiplied by the number of years that a person smoked. I have had cases where the plaintiff had a 100-pack year history. I've also had cases where the pack year history was less than 10. The reality is that both smoking histories can cause lung cancer, even a 10-year smoking history, but you should know the exact amount when preparing your cross-examination. And the last thing that I focus on, which is often ignored by other litigators, but I think it's really important, and that's smoking intake. And this can be measured either by the time that a person spent smoking one cigarette or how many times a person had to inhale a cigarette to finish it. Actually, it's better to get both because then you have some flexibility. While the minutes per cigarette smoked paints a very clear picture you can use effectively, it's really helpful to have the number of inhalations, or we call it drags, how many drags on a cigarette a person had to take, as it was commonly referred to. And I'll explain why both are helpful in a bit. But if you get that, just ask a person, you know, get into a casual conversation with him about his smoking history. How long would it take for you to smoke a cigarette? Would you agree with me it takes 4 to 5 minutes to smoke a cigarette? That's the most common response that I get. Some will say 6-7 minutes, which is even better. Some will say it took 6-8 drags to finish the cigarette. Anything 3, 4, 5, you're good, and you can use that very effectively. One preliminary item, it's always important to find out the brand of cigarettes. From March 1952 until at least May of 1956, Kent cigarettes had a micronite filter that actually contained blue chrysidolite asbestos. Chrysidolite is literally the worst kind of asbestos fiber that exists. It is on the magnitude of 10 times more toxic than other types of asbestos. And so it's a short fiber asbestos, meaning it's much easier to be inhaled into the lungs to impregnate the lung tissue of a person who has inhaled those fibers. So every person who inhaled a Kent cigarette during that period of time, they were literally inhaling chrysidolite into their lungs. Kind of a big deal. Ironically, Lorillard, the company that owned Kent in the 1950s, actually touted their micronite filter as a response to the growing concern that smoking was linked to lung cancer. They actually marketed this as a safer, healthier cigarette. As Alanis Morissette once said, isn't it ironic? So let's return to the smoker hypothetical I posed a short time ago. You have the plaintiff, who's 70 years old, diagnosed with lung cancer 9 months ago, and then he acknowledged his smoking history. What's the best way about questioning the plaintiff at his trial in a way that you are...
Esquire CLE's second verification code is VET. V-E-T. All lowercase. VET. Please take a moment to write this down. Esquire CLE's second verification code is VET. V-E-T. All lowercase. VET. Please take a moment and write this down.
Well positioned to hammer him about his smoking history and making smoking the focus of your cross-examination. Well, as I talked about, you need to be very thorough at the discovery deposition. I know it can be tedious, but it's really important to get every kind of aspect of the person's smoking history down. The brand he smoked, where he smoked. Did he smoke at work? Did he smoke in his home? Did he smoke in his car on the way to work? Those are types of details that will effectively craft a cross-examination. Most of the time, although not always, a plaintiff will be more forthcoming to his treating physician compared to a horrid defense attorney emerging from his wretched hive of scum and villainy to malign an otherwise blameless plaintiff from his payday. If you study the medical records closely before the discovery deposition, and certainly before trial, you can make some hay with this if the plaintiff has a momentary lapse of memory regarding his smoking habit. Answers to interrogatories are helpful. Medical records are key. You need to scour the medical records because that, especially in a lung cancer case for sure, is something that doctors are always going to ask for. Look, even if a plaintiff tries to minimize his smoking history, I can pretty much assure you that you're going to have a lot of ammo with which to work, okay? Let's say a person, you have reason to believe in the medical records that he smoked, had a 35-pack year history in the scenario that I painted for you earlier. Let's say a person admits to smoking half a pack a day for 15 years. That is a 7.5-pack year history. Small potatoes, you say, right? Well, no, let's do the math. Half a pack is 10 cigarettes. Obviously, you need to confirm that. 10 cigarettes every day of the year, every year that person smoked, that's 365 days a year for 7.5 years. Have you ever added that up? I don't know if you have a family, but my parents smoked. I never smoked, but my parents smoked. I never calculated and sat down how many cigarettes somebody smoked. Think about that for a second. 7.5 years. 10 times 365. Forget about leap years. That's, you know, another analysis. That's 3,650 cigarettes per year times 7.5 years. Folks, that is 27,375 cigarettes. I promise you, when you present that number to the plaintiff, it will hit him and the jury like a ton of bricks. Then, and this goes back to topic number four that I mentioned earlier, smoking intake. Then you get into multiplying that by how long it took or how many drags it took to finish a cigarette. And you multiply that number by the intake number. And it will be mind-numbingly large. Even in a case where the plaintiff only, and I say only in quotes, had a 7.5-pack year history. They'll try to minimize the period of time they spent smoking. They'll say, sometimes it wasn't really in my mouth. Sometimes it just was in my mouth. I wasn't inhaling it. Well, that's why the inhalation question is so important. It makes them quantify their actual inhalation of the carcinogenic cigarette. Most of them will tell you 5 to 7 inhalations. That's perfect. That's you can run with that in a way that will gobstop them at trial. 5 times 27,375 is 136,875 inhalations. Enormous. Then you get into everything that's in a cigarette. There are approximately 600 ingredients in a typical cigarette. Want to guess how many of them are good for you? When a cigarette is burned, more than 7,000 chemicals are created by that process. You want to guess how many of them are good for you? According to the American Lung Association, which, by the way, is a pretty authoritative source if someone's attorney wants to dicker around with you on cross, at least 69 of the chemicals caused by the process of smoking a cigarette are carcinogenic. Arsenic, benzene, hexamine, formaldehyde, it's embalming fluid, lead, methanol, it's primary ingredient in rocket fuel. Toluene is used to make paint. Arsenic is rat poison. Yes, nasty, nasty stuff. And your plaintiff, who thought he was being sly about minimizing his smoker history, just admitted to you in front of the jury that he inhaled all sorts of junk into his lungs more than 136,000 times. How about if he spent 4 minutes smoking per cigarette? That's 109,500 minutes. And apologies to the cast of Rent, but that's how you measure an alternative causation history. When you paint a picture of exactly how much that is, it is absolutely staggering. How much is 109,000 minutes? It's 1,825 hours. That's 76 days, folks. Think about that for a second, if you will. 76 days. That's 2.5 months. That's 11 weeks. That's your kid's summer camp. It's starting to smoke at midnight on New Year's Day and not stopping until St. Patrick's Day. 76 days. Your plaintiff just admitted to doing nothing but inhaling deadly, toxic, nasty, cancer-causing cigarette smoking. And he or she thought that he or she was being smart. In case you are wondering how I get them to go through this on this exercise, and you should always do this on your trial cross. Always do this. I always, always, always have a calculator in front of the plaintiff for him to calculate. When I do debene esse depositions for trial, which is very common in my litigation, I make sure I have a calculator present. Now, in the age of COVID, when we were doing all these depositions remotely, it's somewhat more challenging, but I have my calculator there that I can show to the plaintiff on Zoom or whatever virtual method we're using. And most of the time, they're not going to argue with you because it's math. You know, the ones who aren't flat earthers generally have no choice but to accept your math. You just blinded him with science. Yes, I grew up in the 80s. So you go through this setup with your witness. Admit the 20 cigarettes in a package. Admit there are 365 days in a year. Admit that the smoking history is what he gave you on his discovery deposition. And what about our original plaintiff with the 35-pack year history I mentioned at the beginning of today's session? That's 255,500 cigarettes smoked. At 4 minutes of smoking, on average, per cigarette, you have 1,022,000 minutes of smoking. That's 17,000 hours. That's 709 days. That's nearly 2 calendar years of smoking. I promise you, when you go through this on cross-examination in front of the jury, it'll be the first time that plaintiff sees those numbers. And obviously the jury for the first time as well. The impact of that, folks, I cannot minimize how impactful that is at trial. And remember, people in the 60s and 70s smoked everywhere, restaurants, barbershops, stores, everywhere. And we haven't talked much about secondhand smoke, but there are studies that show secondhand smoke being at least as carcinogenic as direct smoking. So you need to go through all of that with the witness. This paints a picture of cigarette smoking being ubiquitous around the time when these people smoked cigarettes. It's important. Some of these folks smoked during work, around their coworkers who are also smoking. Get all of that on the record to show it was everywhere in society. You go to a restaurant, people would be smoking. And in fact, it wasn't until the late 70s and 80s that they started to create smoking sections in restaurants and aircraft. People were still being exposed to secondhand smoke. So if you have a non-smoking plaintiff with lung cancer, don't give up on the secondhand equation. That could be very, very consequential. Now, if they get cute and respond that, say something like, well, some of the warnings didn't say anything about lung cancer, that's actually true. And I will share in the materials some of the warnings that have existed throughout time. These were mandated by the Surgeon General of the United States. That's true. Some of them talked about low birth weight. Some of them talked about cancer generally. But your response questions to that can actually be really effective. If the witness tries to minimize the warnings on a pack of cigarette, your question really should be like, at any time after 1966, did you think that smoking was healthy? Did you think that smoking was good for you? Did you think that smoking cigarettes would enhance your health? Didn't you realize by the 1970s that smoking cigarettes could cause lung cancer? Most of the time, the plaintiffs are stuck. And if they deny it, then they just look dumb and they look like they're hiding something. So the warnings piece of this is really important. One area to focus on is when they quit. Most cases, I've had cases where they have adenocarcinoma of the lung and they continue to smoke. I've had a handful of cases. And those sort of right themselves. But a lot of times, and this is a big thing in asbestos cases, many times the asbestos lawyers will ask questions like, well, you weren't addicted to asbestos, were you? You weren't addicted to talcum powder containing asbestos, were you? And they try to get, you know, somehow that you get addicted to smoking cigarettes, somehow that's beyond your control. Well, in a case where the plaintiff quit, there's an easy way to deal with that. And the area of follow-up is, you say you were addicted, but you quit, right? And you have to say yes. Nobody forced you to smoke after that, right? Every single day, you got up, you could have opened a pack of cigarettes and smoked, right? But you didn't. You quit. Those are the types of cross-examination questions that you have to mold. Look, there's no question that cigarettes contain nicotine, which is addictive, no doubt. The record is replete with evidence that the tobacco companies knew this. They manufactured their products accordingly. I'm not here to defend anything about the use of tobacco or the tobacco companies. On the contrary, I think tobacco has caused more monetary damage to this country in the form of medical treatment, lost man hours, early death, quality of life. Perhaps only the obesity epidemic will prove to be more costly. And that's exactly the point. Do not ever forget that this case is about smoking and the plaintiff's lung cancer. It's not about talc. It's not about talc contaminated with asbestos. It's about cigarette smoking. And one other thing about the warnings, you can use them really effectively. You can tell the plaintiff that even though they're going to throw back the addicted response, your question should always hammer away that you made a choice to start smoking. This was your choice. Nobody made you do this. That's the point of the deposition where you can bring all this home. And there's one final area that I want to get into today. And not a lot of other folks in my field do this, but I started doing it about 10 years ago, and I find it's extremely effective. And you don't care what their answer is. You know that the general rule of trial law is you never ask a question to which you don't know the answer. This is one of those exceptions where you don't care what the answer is, because regardless of what the plaintiff says, the answer is going to be damaging. Here's where you bring it all home. You've just gone through this wonderful exercise where you've added up all of these cigarettes. You've astounded everyone with this enormous history of smoking and intake of all these horrible chemicals that we talked about. And then you get to the part where you tie it together. Ask them if they take any responsibility for their own lung cancer. Say, sir, ma'am, knowing all of this about all the smoking that you did, about all the cigarettes you smoked in your life, about all the hours and minutes you spent inhaling cigarettes that we all agree causes cancer into your lungs, do you accept any responsibility for your disease? I can tell you I've had many occasions where the plaintiff is just utterly, they don't know how to respond to that. Some of them will say, well, I guess I do. Because the reality is, in a smoking lung cancer case, they do. Others can try to brush it off and say, no, I don't take any responsibility. And that's okay, too. You can use that very effectively in your closing. This plaintiff won't even acknowledge the cause of his disease, won't even accept responsibility, and yet we showed you, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, just how significant his exposure to the carcinogens of cigarettes were and what caused this plaintiff's disease. And he won't acknowledge it. Remember, I think the most important lesson you can take from today's CLE is that it is always about the plaintiff's decision to smoke cigarettes. Very briefly, let's talk on never smokers as we wrap up today's discussion. It's obviously a little more complicated in a case where you have a person who never smoked. But you should still be diligent about checking the smoking history. Every once in a while, you'll find evidence that, in fact, the person was a smoker. Maybe they smoked cigars. Maybe they used chewing tobacco. You need to cover all of those things. There may not be a single cause behind a particular case of lung cancer in a non-smoker. Often there is a combination of factors contributing to the disease. And I think I'm going to plan on doing a Esquire class later regarding genetic mutation. This is a huge emerging area of the law. And with regard to the non-smoker lung cancer cases, it's really becoming a very interesting area of exploration. Whether a genetic mutation, so something called a germline mutation, which is normal in our DNA, may be causative or predispose someone to development of cancer. There are numerous studies that have shown mutations or abnormalities can play a key role in the development of lung cancer, including and especially in non-smokers. My firm has really started to evaluate the genetic mutation issues in our cases, and I have to tell you, it's still developing. A lot of our experts are admittedly still getting up to speed on this, and in fact, science really hasn't caught up. I talked earlier about Fry and Daubert, and we have not yet hit Fry and Daubert levels in some of these issues, but for certain mutations, BAP1 and mesothelioma cases, for example, genetic testing is going to be an increasingly important area of investigation going forward. In the non-smokers, I mentioned this earlier, but in the non-smokers, always focus on radon gas. Radon is considered to be one of the causes of lung cancer in non-smokers. It accounts for about 21,000 lung cancer deaths each year. Radon is invisible. It doesn't have a smell, but it occurs naturally outdoors, and it has been found in concentrated amounts inside homes that were built on soil that contains natural uranium deposits. The Environmental Protection Agency actually has a guide on how to test for radon in your home, and they publish a map, and they have three different zones, 1, 2, and 3. And the different zones show where the prevalence of radon exposure is highest. Chances are that you might have a plaintiff that lived for a period of time in a Zone 1 area, and if they didn't have their house tested for radon, that is a perfectly permissible area of inquiry for you to investigate. And there's also secondhand smoke. Okay, we talked about this earlier, but never forget secondhand smoke. The smoke that you breathe in from another person's burning tobacco product, it's linked to an estimated 7,000 lung cancer deaths each year. And we're actually get to the point where U.S. researchers are studying third-hand smoke or invisible nicotine and chemicals that may be left on furniture, walls, clothing, and other surfaces. This is an emerging area of science. We're going to learn more about it in the coming years, and there's a chance that you may find this to be an important part of your non-smoking lung cancer case. Check diesel exhaust. Heavy metals. Some of these folks worked in gas stations or were mechanics. Well, diesel exhaust causes lung cancer. And finally, we have air pollution. The risk of lung cancer from air pollution is still somewhat low in the United States, but it's something you should investigate. So I hope this has been informative for all of you. We could talk literally for hours just about the smoking issues involved in lung cancer cases. I have a 68-page outline, actually, that I use in smoking lung cancer cases. It's not just the smoking aspect of it, but the smoking component of a lung cancer case where they're alleging it's caused by something else. Never, ever forget, folks, lung cancer and cigarettes. That's the whole ball game. If you hold on to that premise and you develop your discovery, your questioning of the plaintiff at the discovery deposition and at trial, I promise you, you will be better off. And there are some really effective tools, counting a person's smoking history, that I promise you they have not thought of. And if you have, you will effectively represent your client at trial. I hope the last hour or so gave you some insight into this issue. And even if it's not your area of practice, it still provides a really good lesson into how to use the minutiae of evidence in a methodical manner that can give you an advantage in your trial cross-examination. Always break it down with the witness to the lowest common denominator possible and make him or her tell your story. It's effective and powerful. My contact information and some of the materials, such as the various warning labels that we talked about, will be on the link for today's program. My email will also be included. If you have any questions regarding today's presentation, please feel free to send me a note, and I will be happy to respond. Thank you all for listening today.